And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2016. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Caroline Levitt and Molly Brodak. First up is Caroline Levitt. Caroline is the author of 11 novels, including the New York Times bestsellers Pictures of You and Is This Tomorrow? Her many essays, stories, book reviews, and articles have appeared in Salon, Psychology Today, the New York Times Sunday Book Review, the New York Times Modern Love, and numerous anthologies. As a screenwriter, Caroline was a 2003 Nickelodeon Screenwriting Fellow finalist and is a recent first-round finalist in the Sundance Screenwriting Lab competition for her script of Is This Tomorrow? Her new novel, Cruel Beautiful World, is an indie next pick and has won an Audiophile Earphones Award, a book club selection for both Reading with Robin and the Pulpwood Queens, and was named one of the best books about starting over by Book Riot, and Cruel Beautiful World is the focus of our talk today. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Glad to have you back. Let's begin by you talking a little bit about Cruel Beautiful World and how the novel came about.
Okay. Well, Cruel Beautiful World is the story of 16-year-old Lucy Gold, who's growing up in the late 1960s, and she falls in love with her 30-year-old English teacher, and they run off to one of the back-to-the-land paradises that were springing up in the early 70s, and she soon finds out that it's a nightmare rather than a paradise. It's also the story of her older sister, Charlotte, who has always taken care of Lucy and now is desperate to find out what happened to her, and it's also the story of their much older adoptive mother who thinks that her life is over when it's really just beginning.
Yes, you had so much going on in this book, and I really loved, I loved a lot of it, but especially Iris's story where it turns out well.
That was my homage. That was sort of my love letter to my mom. My mom really thought her life was over in her 90s, and she went into one of these independent living places, and she's very furious about it, and her life just bloomed. Her life just opened up.
Well, talk about using, I don't know if using is the right word, basing characters sort of in a composite way, I suppose, on people you know, because I think a lot of novelists do this, and maybe some feel guilty about doing this. Others have no problem at all. But I think probably, novelists might feel they're cheating if they're creating composite characters using people they know.
Right. Well, first of all, I never feel that I'm cheating, because as soon as I put a line on the page, it takes a life of its own. But originally, Cruel Beautiful World was based on a girl that I sat behind in high school when I was 17. And while I was talking about, being a writer and going off to Europe, she told me she had been engaged for 2 years already to a much older boyfriend who was a little controlling, and that as soon as she was 18, they were going to get married. And I thought that was really bizarre, and I didn't understand it. And when I got out of college, I heard from friends that she had actually decided to leave him, and he was so upset by this that he went into the kitchen and got a knife and stabbed her 42 times. So that was the thing that sort of initially propelled the novel, but it really wasn't my friend's story at all. I changed the time frame. I changed a lot of what happened to her, but there were still people who came up to me and said, "Why are you doing this? You're going to cause pain to the family again." And I kept saying, "Well, it's really not her story at all. The only thing that's similar about her and my character are that they are both in love with older, controlling men. And secondly, I feel that it's the novelist's job to go really deep and dark, and sometimes you pull stuff from all of your experience. It's always fair game. And so that part of it was there. My mother has dementia, so it's actually sad because I think she would have been really, really happy that I used parts of her life. The only other person whose life I used in the book was my relationship with my sister growing up when we were very, very close. And I, like Charlotte, kept trying to fix my sister's troubled life and failed. And I don't know how she feels about that because she hasn't told me. But again, it's not really her. It's this living, breathing character on the page.
Yeah, and as far as your friend is concerned, and her story, it's not as if many, many women haven't experienced, maybe not something that horrible, but, you know, upset boyfriends and husbands that they are breaking up with. I mean, this is a pretty common theme.
Right. Exactly. And all of the other themes that I've dealt with, I think, are universal, or at least I hope they are.
What about your family? I mean, do you ever, with your books, do you ever say, you know, maybe don't read this one?
I've never said that to them, although they have told me, before my mother had dementia, she has said, you know, I'm not going to read this, or she has always thought that any mother in the book was her, which actually was never her until this one. And my sister, as I said, has a lot of struggles in her life, and she really has not read my last three books. So I've kind of stopped trying to fix our relationship because every time I do, I make it worse. But interestingly enough, my very first novel actually had a lawsuit from some people who I didn't know, who were sure that the book was about them because it happened to have the same name that they did. The lawsuit was eventually dropped, but I did have to change two of the names in the paperback edition, and I had no idea who these people were. So I think that readers bring a lot when they to the table when they read books, and sometimes they see themselves and sometimes they don't. And there's really nothing you can do about that.
And I would think also sometimes friends / readers are offended that you didn't base a character on them.
True. Sometimes it is. I've had one friend who asked me why I didn't at least put her name in the book, you know, as a character or just talking to somebody. And I thought, well, I never really thought of doing that.
Yeah.
But
well, you know, early on in Cruel, Beautiful World, you foreshadow what's going to happen with your protagonist, Lucy. I wonder if you talk about the decision to do this.
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really great question, because originally I didn't have that foreshadowing, and I took it out, and the chapter just didn't seem as strong, especially if the next chapter was going to be going back into the rest of the family. So I wrote it out, and I went over and over thinking, well, is it okay to do this? Does it tell too much, or does it hold back too much? And I worked with my editor on it for a while, and she gave the final decision where she said, you know, I think it's good, because it's not so much that we know exactly what's going to happen to Lucy, but it's enough to know, uh-oh, something is not right. And that's why I decided to keep it.
Interesting. What about the multiple points of view? How did you decide on that?
That was kind of a nightmare, actually, because I had so many characters. I usually have only three or four characters, and this one has like five or six. As I was writing them out, I really wanted to understand them, and to do that, a lot of times I do these little exercises where I just will write in a character's point of view for a while just to see what's going on with them. And the more I did that, the more I liked the characters and the more I wanted to give them all a voice. So in the end, that's what I did. It was very hard to juggle where to put which point of view and how to keep the narrative drive going. But I had a lot of help with my editor who helped me map it out, like what should go where. But I found that I loved doing it. I just loved having all those characters and all those voices.
Well, you know, speaking of your editor, talk about working with your editor on the book and how perhaps it changed from, you know, the draft you handed in to the published version.
It changed tremendously. My editor for my last three books was Andrea Miller at Algonquin, and she, we call ourselves soul sisters on the page because she sort of knows what I'm trying to do before I do it. And originally when I turned the book in, I had much more negativity between the sisters and between the mother, between Iris. Iris didn't really want to be a mother to the girls. And it was much, much darker. And Andre said, you know, I really think you need to find the love between these people. And I originally objected because I said, I don't want to write a nicey-nicey book. I want to write a really dark, thorny novel. And she said, it can still be dark and thorny if you find the love between them. And in fact, that bonds between them will make it even more tragic, which I think is what you want. So I trust her, so I agreed to try it, and I realized she was right. She was absolutely right. So I, you know, I changed them. Iris became a nicer person with much more substance. The two sisters really loved each other much more than they did in my original version. And the book took on layers and depth that I never would have known to put there if Andre hadn't suggested that, and if I hadn't been willing to try her suggestion.
Do you have a certain number of drafts you'll put a novel through? Like, how many drafts did this go through?
Oh, this one was about 18. I've lost count because usually what I do is I do about 5 drafts before I send it to my agent, and I show all those drafts to a few writer friends, and they give feedback, and then I do another draft, which I give to my agent. And my agent always wants me to rewrite again, so I do that for her. And then for my editor, usually it's like 2 or 3, and the changes get smaller and smaller as we went along. But even in the page proof stage, where you're really not supposed to change too much, we were making little paragraph changes up to the last minute. And I'm glad we did.
I'd love to hear you read from Cruel Beautiful World. Would you do that?
I would love to. I'm going to read this part where Lucy has fallen in love with William, her teacher. William knows she's in love with him, and he's confused about his own feelings. So he's asked her to come to his apartment so they can talk about it. And this is where it starts. Did you change your mind? She said, standing outside William's door. Yes, no, I don't know. Come inside. His place was small and bright with sun. She didn't know what to do, so she waited. Sit, he ordered. We have to talk about this. She moved gingerly to the edge of his couch, but he kept moving around the room, pacing. You think it's just you, and it's not, he said finally. What's not, Lucy said. I get to school, and you're the only person I want to talk to, he said. How insane is that? Me too, she said, but he lifted his hand. Let me finish, he said. All day things happen, and I keep thinking, I want to tell Lucy this. I want to show Lucy this article. I wonder what Lucy would think of this piece I heard on the radio. I feel like that about you, Lucy said. Don't say that, William told her. Please don't say that. This whole situation is ridiculous. I'm your teacher. You're my student. He dug his hands into his pockets, his face tense, pulled together like a purse. I can't stop thinking about you, he said. What's wrong with me that I can't? He shook his head. You don't look 16. You don't act 16. I have a friend who met his wife when she was 15 and he was 25. Everyone told him it would never work, that he was too old for her, that it was wrong, but they didn't listen. She's 70 now and he's 80. The age difference means nothing. It's a blink. Can you imagine? Way back then, they just knew. They just recognized something or the other. What's age, really, Lucy? Haven't you known some impossibly immature adults? Some really wise old people, young people? He finally stopped pacing. You're an old soul, Lucy. You don't think like 19. You don't think like 30, she said abruptly. And he laughed, dry as a cough. How would you know what 30 thinks like, he said. Lucy stood up and moved towards him and kissed him. He pushed her back, but she kissed him again, and then she felt him gently at first, and then harder and harder, lowering her to the floor as if she were a captive. They're together later, more and more, and then they decide that the only solution is to run away, to hide out off the grid where William has a teaching job at a free school. They'll stay until Lucy's 18, and then they'll marry. Once she's inside the car when they're ready to go, he turns towards her. She feels as if she were dipped in gold. She wants to say, I love you. She wants to thank him for rescuing her, but when she does, he says, you're the one who rescued me. For a moment, before the car peels out, she wonders whether she's left anything behind, whether she's making the right decision. She feels a pang for her mom, Iris, how Iris will be hurt when she discovers Lucy is gone. She'll be frightened, too. She wonders whether Iris will call the police and what they'll do and how they'll do it. She fingers her sister Charlotte's red scarf and knows her sister will be furious with her. But Charlotte will forgive Lucy when she learns the truth. She always does, and she just has to. Lucy will miss them a lot, but there's no other way for her. She doesn't know, can't yet imagine what this will do to them, what will happen to her, how it will all end up splashed across the newspaper, but she won't be around to read it.
Thank you so much. That was Caroline Levitt reading from Cruel, Beautiful World, published by Algonquin. So the William character, where did he come from?
Well, I was thinking a lot about what kind of a relationship my friend in high school really had with her boyfriend, who I had never met. And then about 10 years later, I got into my fiancé died very suddenly before our wedding. And after 4 months of grieving, I figured the only way out was to hurl myself in a new relationship, even though everybody told me, no, that's a bad idea. But I got involved in this relationship with this guy because he seemed like a future, and he kept me busy. And it wasn't until after 4 months with him I began to realize that he was starting to be controlling. And he never did anything physical, never raised his voice, always talked in a soft, gentle tone of voice. And the more he talked to me about what was wrong with me or what he would like to see changed, because he was being so gentle and caring, I thought, maybe he's right. I lost sense of who I was. He began to monitor my food because he thought I was too heavy, even though I was 100 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
And I went down to 95 pounds. He didn't want me to see my friends because he thought they were a bad influence. And he didn't want me to see his friends because he thought that I was flirting with them. And finally, the only thing that made me leave was he went into my computer one day when I wasn't home, and he deleted a whole chapter of my novel In Progress and replaced it with this comic interlude full of Groucho Marx jokes. And I was so appalled, and I asked him, did you do this? How could you do this? This is my work. And he stood very quietly, and he said in this quiet, loving voice, honey, there is no you. There is no me. This is the way it's always going to be from now on. There's only us, and you have to learn that. And as soon as he said that, something snapped in me, and I left. I was finally able to leave. And I thought about that a lot, how sometimes emotional abuse, it doesn't look like what you think it looks like. It's actually much more dangerous, and it's a very easy trap to fall into. And I wanted to explore that with William, somebody who thinks he's doing the right thing for Lucy, but actually is most definitely not.
Interesting. Creepy.
Yes, very creepy.
So, you know, from, you know, what you're saying about this novel, and we've talked before, it sounds like, you know, you have these different aspects of your past that you're somehow able to corral when you're working on a project. And how much of that is kind of forethought, and how much of that happens when you're sitting down at the computer or with the tablet and getting down the rough draft?
mostly all of it happens when I'm at the computer. It's sort of, I never really realized that I was writing about my relationship with my sister until the next to the last draft, when all of a sudden it became real to me. I thought, oh my God, I hadn't intended to do this. I really hadn't intended to make Iris a full-fledged character in the first drafts either. And then suddenly, the more I was grappling with my mother's dementia, the more I wanted to write this part of her that was wonderful when she was still mentally aware. And it just sort of happened. And the more it happened, the more I just had this feeling in my gut that this is the right thing to do.
Mm, interesting. You know, I want to sort of take a little side route here, because I don't think I realized that you wrote screenplays. And I wondered if you could talk about that, and probably more specifically, I cut something out from the New Yorker. What's the date on here? August 2015. It has something to do with Joan Didion. And she said, I learned a lot of fictional technique from script writing. And I wondered for you, what's the crossover between script writing?
It's exactly right. It's exactly right. I learned a lot about fiction from screenwriting. I originally started to write scripts because I was tired of getting film options for my novels and nothing ever happening. So I decided that maybe if I wrote the script myself, that would help things. And I was teaching online at UCLA, and one of my students mentioned this guy, John Truby, who has this story structure class. And she said, oh, it works for novels too. And I was very skeptical, because back then I didn't believe in story structure. I thought you just, you know, write from your heart and your gut. And I knew that scripts were very different from novels. But she sent me all these tapes, and I started to listen to them. And it was like a revelation to me, because Truby doesn't talk about things in terms of first act, second act, third act. He talks about things in terms of moral choices. What is it the character wants and why? What's the character's misconception about what he or she wants? And how are they going to discover that misconception and maybe heal it and possibly give way to finding out what they really need? And as soon as I read that, I felt electrified, because I thought, oh my God, this is a way to structure a novel through character. And I started to map out my novels before I wrote them, knowing that they would change as I wrote them. But at least then I began to know the beginning, the middle, and the end. And a lot of my novelist friends said, well, doesn't it take away the creativity? And actually it adds to it, because you have this solid skeleton that you start out with, which is the story structure, and then you can add to it. You add the flesh and the hair and the clothes and the eye color and everything else until you have a living, breathing entity. And I use those Truby story structure principles all the time when I'm writing novels. They really help you with the narrative drive.
Interesting. We are almost at the end of our time. How can that be?
Oh, no.
And I wonder if in the, you know, couple of minutes we have left, you could talk about how you are so prolific, especially during difficult times, because I think a lot of writers for the last however long have had such a hard time getting things done. And you know, if you're a writer, you have to write. And talk about that, how you're able to keep your discipline.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the hard times that happen in my life. I almost died when I was in ninth grade with a lung infection. And then after I had my son, I had a rare blood disease, and I was in the hospital for 4 months, and nobody expected me to live. And then, of course, it was my fiancé dying. And every time one of those things happened, I had this real sense that life can turn on a dime. Life is very short. And if there's something you want to do or something you want to express, you better do it now. So I've always had this sensation of there's not a lot of time, so I have to keep writing. And I also have this feeling that I have to do as much good in the world as I can. And the best way I can do that is perhaps by writing novels that will touch something in people or help them heal over something or make them more aware of a situation or just be kinder to one another. And I think especially now in this climate, that connection with other people and that sense of what can I give you, what can I contribute, is even more important than ever. So I try to never stop doing that because I feel like it's the most important thing I can do.
Caroline Leavitt, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the brilliant questions. I loved answering them.
Oh, it's always fun to talk to you. Thank you. That was Caroline Leavitt. Her book is Cruel Beautiful World, published by Algonquin. And you can find more on her website. She's on Facebook. And we should have taken an hour. I say this more and more. We're going to take a real quick break. I will drink some water, try to get my cold under control. And we should be back in just a few minutes with our next guest. So please stay with us.
Thank you.
And that was Volare, the Italian-American Songbook by Antonio Chacca Quintet. Love it. Just discovered it in the stacks here. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're back with our next guest. But before we get her on, let me tell you that the views and opinions you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of me and my guests. And if you want to access podcasts of the show, we put them up generally about a week or so after the live broadcast. If you go to iTunes, you can subscribe to Writers on Writing. And if you want to leave a review for us, that will help us in the standing so other listeners can find the show. My next guest is Molly Brodack. She's from Michigan and currently lives in Georgia. Her poems have recently appeared in Field, Kenyon Review, Ninth Letter, and Colorado Review. Her first book of poetry, A Little Middle of the Night, won the 2009 Iowa Poetry Prize. And she's here to talk about her new memoir, Bandit, a daughter's memoir. Let's bring her on. Hi, Molly.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. Let's begin by you talking a bit about the genesis of your memoir.
Sure. I had been writing poetry since I was a kid, and I basically avoided writing about my family for years until I think I felt like I was maybe strong enough to handle the story, since it's been a pretty intense story. So, it was always in the back of my mind that I knew I would get to it and write it, but I think I really just needed to mature and be able to handle it. So I started writing it when I had a fellowship at Emory University here in Atlanta, and it took about 2 years to write and another year to edit and sort of get it ready for publication.
I wonder if we can go a bit deeper into, actually, it's very much about your family, very much about your father. And wonder how it was to write so personally, in terms of, did you worry about your family reading this memoir later and how they would react, or how did you keep them sort of out of the room?
That's a good question. I started writing from the standpoint of journaling. I've been keeping a diary and a journal since I was, a kid. And so I had to start writing this memoir as if I was just writing in my diary. And I told myself that no one was ever going to read this and that this was just for me. It was the only way that I could access my true feelings about things and be completely honest about them. So in other words, I had to just pretend like they weren't ever going to read it and none of this would ever actually see the light of day. And so I wrote the whole thing thinking that, in my mind, it was all safe in a way. It was all safe to say anything. And then I sort of had to work back from there once it was written in terms of editing it and thinking about them reading it. But really, I've only just recently, since the book has been published, recently started dealing with the fact that my family has read it and they know about it, and it's been hard. But I think you have to, if you really want to be honest in a memoir, you have to write it, boldly without any, without holding anything back or worrying about anybody else, while you're writing it. So that's how I had to do it. I just had to just sort of dissociate from them. In the end, I think they do understand. There's some stuff that I think they wish I would have walked back or not admitted to, but they understand. I think they see that I'm a writer and that, the truth is, I'm beholden to the truth in a way.
Mm. This would be a great time to hear you read from Bandit. Could you do that?
Sure. So this is the moment my mom and I found out that my dad had been arrested for bank robbery.
Okay.
My sister was 15 that summer. She was there when it happened. I wasn't. It was something I was told about, told by mom, told by the cops, told by reporters, just like everyone else watching the news was told. It was a story like a dark new house we had to move to. Mom and I now live in a condo her parents had bought her in a humble complex on Ironwood Street in Rochester, Michigan, where we'd stay for 4 years, the longest I have lived anywhere. I'd go all the way through high school without having to move because I realized later, Dad, the disrupting factor in our lives, would be in prison after the summer. It was nearing the end of summer, and Mom and I had just come home from vacation. Although at the time, as a preteen, camping was not vacation, but pointless traveling drudgery. We were tired from the drive back from Canada and dirty from the week-long camping and hiking along the coast of the Georgian Bay in Lake Superior, swimming briefly in the icy water or taking glass-bottom boat tours of old shipwrecks. Mom pressed the blinking button on the answering machine, and I dragged my bag upstairs to unpack. In my small room, I dumped my stinky clothes out and just sat for a moment, listening to the muffled sound of Mom on the phone downstairs. Then I started listening to it, really. Her voice was getting louder and sharper. I had already moved back towards the stairs when she called my name. She sat in the kitchen, at the kitchen table, the extra-long curly phone cord stretched to her as she held the receiver with her thumb on its button. Her voice was keyed high with exasperation. "That was Grandpa. Your father has been arrested, and your sister is staying with them." I paused for a while, staring calmly. "What did he do?" "Robbed banks." She looked at me, and we didn't say anything. She hadn't tensed up or pinched her face in anger. In fact, her face cleared out flat, like the look of someone who's just remembered something. "Robbed banks?" I finally said. "Robbed banks," she repeated dreamily. "Bank robbery." "You don't say," she murmured to herself, nodding blankly. It didn't feel like some kind of mistake, like it sometimes feels when you don't want to believe what's happened. It was horrible how easy it was to accept. Almost funny, in the pressure I silenced, the beginnings of a laugh could have crept over me, but I fought it. The room felt dark and solid as iron. I didn't cry or scream. I remember standing for a while in the kitchen, looking at the linoleum floor and saying nothing, feeling like I was waiting for instructions. In some ways, I felt this was good. I probably felt some relief. He'd been removed from our lives in an official and secure way. It solved him in a way that none of us could. He was exposed, finally, made into something specific, a bank robber. It was terrifying, for sure, but satisfying in how pinned down Dad suddenly was in this moment.
Thank you so much. That was Molly Brodack reading from Bandit, A Daughter's Memoir, published by Grove Atlantic. You didn't read from the first chapter, but I wanted to talk about the first chapter because it was so effective in drawing me in. And it, you know, it begins with you as a young girl stealing a baby name's book and your father marching you back into the store, returning the book, making you apologize. And I wondered if that first chapter was always the first chapter or if that came later.
I think it wasn't always the first chapter. A lot of stuff got moved around in this book in editing. And I decided in the editing stage with working with my editor at Grove that I really wanted that to be the first chapter because I think it sets up, first of all, it sets up myself as someone who is like a normal kid and makes mistakes, and my dad is a normal dad who tries to kind of, you know, correct his daughter's behavior. But then also, I think, interestingly, the whole scene kind of gets flipped on its ear the more you read and you realize that he becomes the one who is the thief. So I feel good about starting the book on a note of sort of implicating myself and sort of maybe setting up the indication that I too, you know, am a bandit or have some reflection of him and me. Because I didn't want this book to be just purely an indictment of him. I think that there's a lot about his life that was really normal and maybe even really good. So I think that scene kind of illustrates some of that complexity.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, it's, you know, it's short and pithy and to the point. And, you know, after you read that chapter, you can't really put the book down. You have to keep going with it. I also wanted to talk about how, you know, the book is very much about your dad and his journey, his life. But it's so much about you, of course, and your journey. I wondered how you balanced the threads and if that was a challenge.
Yeah, it was a huge challenge. That was something that I struggled with a lot because I really didn't want to write a biography of him. It wasn't something I set out to do. So I tried to frame it as a memoir about my life, but his life is such an overriding factor in a way for determining, you know, how I grew up and what happened to me, especially as a child and a young person. So yeah, I had to work on balancing that and making sure that his story sort of didn't eclipse mine, and that mine still sort of made sense as a story by itself. That was tricky, and I'm not sure in the end if I really struck the perfect balance, but I definitely was trying to make it a memoir that that, you know, had my dad as kind of a shaping factor. So a bit of biography too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you go through, you know, a stint seeing if you like gambling and mm-hmm. some other things. And, you know, I thought that was really interesting because then I learned a little bit about gambling and probably why I don't do it. But, but then,
yeah,
you know,
me too.
You talked a lot about, you know, the con man. And I was, you know, I think some of us have had con men and women in our lives. And I love the line. I think it's something like a con always begins with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I wonder if you can talk about that.
Yeah, I have that in there in the section that's talking about his claim that he had PTSD as sort of an excuse for why he decided to sort of suddenly snap and rob banks. And I struggle with that a lot because it's true. He did go to Vietnam and he did, I think, two tours and certainly saw some grisly things in his days as a, you know, as a soldier. But I don't really buy that he had PTSD. My mom is a clinical psychologist, so she definitely knows what it looks like, and she's trained to, you know, understand disorders like that. So she didn't think that he had it either. She thinks that he just sort of pulled that out in court to try to get an easier sentence. And I think it worked. I think that they definitely took more pity on him because he was a veteran. And so I say that line in reference to his trauma. You know, like, he has been through a lot of trauma, and he's been through very difficult things in his life with his family and with the war. But I think he adjusted pretty well, and I think he's one of the people who doesn't have PTSD coming home from war. So, yeah, I think I do believe that in order to get a really good con going, there does have to be some shred of truth that you can kind of cling to and elaborate on and build. And so is there trauma? Definitely. But was he in a state of disorder because of it? Not really. So, I think that there's always this little seed, you know, in every great lie. And he lied about so many things. And the more I dug, the more I found that little kernel in his lies, that it really did make me feel more sympathy from him in my research, because, you know, I realized that there were certain shreds of truth underneath all of his lies.
Talk about the title. I love the title Bandit. And, of course, as I read the book, I know why it's there. But at what point did it come? Was it always the title?
It wasn't the title. I was given that title by my agent when we were shopping it around. I had some long title that didn't even make sense, and it wasn't very, very catchy. And he just said, well, I think the title should just be Bandit. And, you know, I wanted to sell the book. So I said, okay, you know. So we went with that. And I think it makes sense. I mean, the reason I was hesitant about that was that, you know, like I said, I wanted it to be a memoir, and I was worried with the title Bandit that people would think, like, I'm the bandit or something, you know. So so that's why we have the subtitle, Bandit, A Daughter's Memoir. So I think that with the subtitle kind of tells the whole story of the book pretty well. And, yeah, the title is, it's a word that is really loaded for me because on one hand, you know, my dad is a, you know, convicted felon and he's a bank robber. But on the other hand, he's my dad and I don't really think of him first and foremost as those things. So it's weird. It's kind of weird and hard for me to see that word or that name in reference to him sort of standing alone. But I do hope that the book kind of fills in the blanks a little bit more, you know?
Yeah, it sure does. It sure does. I enjoyed it very much. I kind of ripped through it.
Thank you.
You know, we always talk a little bit about the business of writing on this show, and I wondered if you could talk about that in terms of, did you write the entire memoir before you got an agent, or did you go the proposal route, or maybe if you could talk a little bit about the selling of the memoir.
Mm-hmm, sure. I wrote the whole thing before I thought about agents or selling or anything. I had to kind of get into a very, you know, intense sort of vulnerable state to write about these things. So I didn't want to get anybody involved too early. So I sat down to write it, and I wrote it in very short pieces. And the book is still divided up into very short chapters, which is essentially how I was writing each section, just as these little bursts. And part of that, I think, is because I'm a poet, and I would just get into these habits of, you know, being very brief and sort of trying to economize my words. And I struggled with, in fact, trying to fill out some of the details at times because I'm so used to trying to say as much as possible in as few words as possible. So yeah, I sat down and wrote it in these small pieces, and I didn't really show it to anybody. I didn't get any input on it as I was writing it. I just wanted to let myself stay in that very honest and sensitive place that you have to go to write about your real life. And then once it was pretty much finished, I showed it to an agent, and the first agent I showed it to took the book and said he wanted to work with me, and so it all happened really fast. Once I found an agent, he showed it around to some publishers, and we got a call from someone at Grove, and I talked to the editor who I ended up working with about the book on the phone before she decided to buy it. And I think she was kind of just feeling me out about the process of the book, because the book has a really sort of unorthodox structure. And I think she was trying to gauge if I meant to do that or if I didn't know what I was doing. And I sort of just wrote in these odd pieces and in this odd way. So we had a really good conversation about it, and then they put in an offer, and my agent said, I think you should take this offer. So it was just like boom, boom, boom. It happened really fast, and we didn't really try to go anywhere else after that, because I really liked Grove Atlantic, and I mm-hmm. wanted to work with them. So I was really happy about the first offer, and I just said, yes, you know, no problem. Yeah, it happened between showing it to the agent and selling it. I think it was like 2 or 3 months. I mean, it was crazy, like how fast it happened. So yeah, then it took a long time to edit it. It took a long time because we just went back and forth on a lot of stuff. And I had my very you know, particularly poetic vision of how I wanted the memoir to be written. And she was trying to pull me back from that to some extent. So it was a long, very difficult process of editing, but the book is so much better because of it. So I'm very happy with that.
Yeah, and the structure, I really like the structure, and I like the snippets, the short chapters. And did that change as you got into the editing process? Did the structure change, or did she want you to lengthen chapters, or how did that go?
Yeah, it did. It changed a little. I mean, it's just, essentially the DNA of the book is the same, but she was often just trying to draw me out. So she would say, you know, I think you need more here, or more there, and I would just kind of fill in some blanks. And the order changed a lot. It was a lot more, you know, sort of reflexive in a way. I wrote it with these kind of flashback patterns, and she wanted it to be more chronological. She wanted me to just kind of start when I was little and move towards, you know, present day. And so the book essentially follows that trajectory with some sort of zigzags. But yeah, it changed a lot in the editing process. And she put in so much thought and effort into helping me with the structure. I'm really grateful for that.
Well, thank you so very much for taking the time to come on the show. I know your sister just had a baby, and this is probably a busy time for you. So I really appreciate you taking the time, Molly. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Molly Brodack. Her book is Bandit, and it's published by Grove Atlantic. And for all you memoir writers out there, it's really a good one, and a good one to study in terms of structure and how she did it. It was really a fast read and very enjoyable and quite shocking at times, of course. Anyway, we're at the end of our time. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we'll be back next week, same time. If you missed any of the show, you can go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing, and you will get notification when we upload the show. And that's it for now. Have a great holiday. We'll see you next week.